In the split second that it takes to fire a handgun, three things occur. An optical flash when an explosive charge is ignited to propel the bullet from the chamber of the weapon, a muzzle blast that generates an impulse sound wave, and a shock wave that occurs as the bullet moves through the air at 1,700 miles per hour. At 140 decibels, the sound wave generated by a typical handgun is louder than a military jet, and in the quiet of night, it can be heard up to a distance of 2 miles. Today, we'll hear from Professor Mitchell Weiss about his case entitled ShotSpotter. I'm your host, Brian Kenny, and you're listening to Cold Call.
So we are all sitting there in the classroom. The
professor walks in. And
they look up, and you know it's coming. Oh, the dreaded cold call.
Mitch Weiss is in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School, and he created and teaches the school's course on public entrepreneurship. Prior to joining HBS in 2014, Mitch was the chief of staff to Boston's legendary mayor, Thomas Menino. You probably called him Tom, is that right?
Mayor all the way.
Yeah. Mitch, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure that in the role that you were in before, you bring a lot just in terms of understanding of how municipalities work and how police departments work and all this other stuff. So I think it's going to be really interesting for people to get your take on it, both as the case writer and somebody who's kind of lived in this world. But maybe you can start just by kind of setting up the case for us. Who's the protagonist and what's going on?
The case starts with Ralph Clark. It's been about 30 minutes since gunfire erupted in an Oakland neighborhood, actually about 30 minutes from where he lives. But the gunfire was actually picked up by the sensors that ShotSpotter, Inc., his company, has deployed in Oakland. And they've been picked up by the sensors and analyzed and confirmed as gunfire. And the police departments, the social workers, others have eventually been notified that there's been gunfire in this neighborhood. And Ralph Clark is sitting there and he's watching all these personnel who've showed up because his technology works, the technology of his company. And he's feeling somewhat gratified by that, that people are going to be responded to, that a community is going to be responded to. But he's also got in his mind all the other requests he's been getting for ShotSpotter technology in the wake of mass shootings in schools, in the wake of terrorism. People are saying, isn't there more that ShotSpotter can do? And he and Damian Journey, also an HBS MBA class of 2005, are wondering, you know, what should the company do? Should they extend the product into other markets to address these mass shootings as terrorism, or should they stay focused on serving urban markets?
Great, great. So what prompted you to write this case? How did you even hear about ShotSpotter?
Well, I had originally heard of ShotSpotter, as you said, Brian, when I was in the city in Boston. It's a technology that's deployed in Boston. It's a technology that's deployed in now 90 cities across the United States, many cities with highly concentrated instances of gunfire, neighborhoods where there's unfortunately a prevalence of gunfire, utilize that technology. So I'd heard of it in my prior life, but I was keenly interested in running a case on it, I suppose, for a couple reasons. One is there's a lot of talk about smart cities these days, and smart cities maybe is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's on its way to becoming a multi-billion dollar industry. But in truth, if you look out there at the number of products that have actually been deployed in cities, connected devices that are actually deployed in cities, actually making a difference in people's lives, it's actually not that much these days. And ShotSpotter is an example of one of those. I thought it'd be interesting to look at that, and as well, this issue of can we move from selling to government to selling in adjacent industries is a question I was keenly interested in. A lot of companies ask me, you know, I study and research public entrepreneurship, and they ask me, look, if I get started selling to government, maybe after that hospitals, maybe after that universities. Yeah. And this was a question that Ralph and Damian were wrestling with.
And we'll definitely get into that because I think that's a really interesting aspect of the case and an interesting challenge that they faced. But before we go there, you know, some of this case is sort of ripped from the headlines. Gun violence is sort of front and center and very much in people's consciousness, and we see it on the news every night. Can you sort of give us the landscape of gun violence? I mean, how prevalent is it?
So I think there's maybe three important things to know. One is that violent crime in this country is at a low from its peak in the 90s. So it's down from those moments, but it's still high and acutely high if you compare us to the rest of the world. So like in 2015, there were something like 13,000 people killed and 27,000 injured by gunfire. If you don't include suicides, this is data gathered by the Gun Violence Archive. Mm-hmm. And that problem becomes especially acute when you look in cities and especially when you look in certain neighborhoods of cities where they are plagued by gun violence. But in addition to that data, which we know, there's a lot of data we don't know, which is how much gunfire is there.
Yeah.
And gunfire, ShotSpotter thinks, is recorded based on their data and some data some other scholars have done. Maybe 20% of all gunfire even goes reported at all.
Wow.
80% for one of every five gunshots isn't reported at all. And the question then becomes, what are the costs of that? You know, gun violence, we know its costs. We know its physical and emotional toll it takes on people injured, killed, and their families. But gunshots themselves, even if they don't hit people, still lead to trauma in those neighborhoods, stress in the kids who live in those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we don't actually have such a great handle on. The best data actually probably comes from ShotSpotter themselves.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about ShotSpotter. So for people who don't know, what's their business?
ShotSpotter Flex is their main business, and essentially they're acoustic sensors that are deployed in urban neighborhoods where there's usually a high prevalence of gunfire. And they're employed on basically above the ground on buildings and other fixtures. And what they do is they basically can sense gunfire. They're essentially able to discern gunfire from other kinds of noises,
mm-hmm.
by sensing the ambient audio in the neighborhoods, and then relaying, if they think it's gunfire, relaying that into the cloud, where there's algorithms that ShotSpotter has developed that can help differentiate whether it was gunfire, whether it was a car backfiring, yeah. whether it was a fireworks, whether it was construction noise. They have these algorithms that analyze these and try to confirm that they were gunfire or not. Then they're relayed to an incident response center actually based in Newark, California at ShotSpotter's headquarters. And there are trained experts there who then listen to the waveforms, they listen to the noise and see the waveforms,
yeah.
and confirm whether or not they were gunfire, relay that to the police departments, the 911 dispatchers and those municipalities that have purchased the ShotSpotter Flex service. From there, it's up to the cities to deploy personnel, et cetera, et cetera.
How long does it take for all that to happen?
It's a matter of seconds. I was actually there in the incident response center. To be honest, it's a bit haunting. It's
yeah.
like tuning into the gunfire epidemic in this country. But between in the urban area, into the cloud, into the experts' ears, back to the city is a matter of moments.
Yeah.
Actually, I thought, Brian, it'd be interesting if we could see if you can discern gunfire from other things, give a little test and see how this technology works.
I'm game.
You
want to give that a try, yeah.
Okay, so I have a couple of clips here and you have to tell me whether they're gunfire or not.
Okay. Do I get a repeat or do I just get the one?
Just the one.
I am going to say that's not gunfire.
Okay, that is gunfire. Let's give you another try,
okay.
though. We'll give you another try.
Okay. That sounds like hammers on a roof or something to me.
That's gunfire too.
Wow.
Okay,
I'm doing really badly.
Well, it's hard. It's
yeah.
hard. It lets you see how just how precise the technology is and also how well-trained their experts are. Okay, one last one.
I got to go with the law of averages and say that that's not gunfire because the other two were.
So that's not gunfire. That's actually my daughter stepping on an Amazon packaging bubble. But you can see how hard it would be to pick that up.
Yeah.
Even outdoors, and then as we talk about in the case, as the company thinks about moving indoors, just how difficult it's going to be to basically discern gunfire from other noises.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, we've all been outside during the warm months or whatever at night, and you hear some kind of a pop, and you think, well, it's got to be a firecracker, you know, it couldn't be a gun kind of thing. But I would imagine in an urban setting, that takes on an entirely different complexion.
It does, and the issue there is that even if residents are confident that it is gunfire, they're in many cases unlikely to call the police about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where ShotSpotter comes in. Because, unfortunately, it can be so prevalent, they may wonder themselves, what value is it in me calling the police? Because there's a fear of retribution, they think, well, I don't want to be the one to call the police. Because in some cases, there's tension that exists in this neighborhood between the police and the neighborhoods. Some residents don't want to invite the police into their neighborhood at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that gunfire goes unreported is not just because people don't know that it's gunfire. There's all these other much more complex, much more embedded reasons why people don't report it. And this is where ShotSpotter can come in. This is why Ralph Clark is so committed to the mission of his company in terms of sort of denormalizing gun violence, making sure that even when these gunshots aren't reported, they're at least sensed,
mm-hmm.
and that authorities can respond and can try to build trust with the communities that they're in.
And the police like it. The police, based on the case, it gets great results.
Yeah, I mean, overwhelmingly positive response by the police departments who use it. Many of the cities in which it's been deployed have seen significant reductions in gunfire over the first couple of years that it's there. A couple of caveats to that. First of all, Ralph would be the first to tell you, you can't say it's because of ShotSpotter. ShotSpotter is one tool in a toolkit of strategies that law enforcement can use with the community to try to bring gun violence down. Mm-hmm. But knowing of it, being aware of it, responding to it, being proactive about it is key. The second point there is that it's not just about knowing about it, it's also about doing something about it. Mm-hmm. And while most cities have seen overwhelming success in it, you know, a handful of times cities have said it's not for us. And usually I think in ShotSpotter's estimation, it's because it hasn't been part of a comprehensive crime reduction strategy, community policing strategy, and it won't work on its own.
Yeah, and for ShotSpotter, there were some challenges that they encountered when they were trying to figure out the sales process behind this and the procurement process on the customer side.
Yeah, in the early going, I think it was harder than Ralph thought it would be. He had experienced a number of technology firms, but not really ones that had such a focus in selling to cities. And over time, though, they really developed an expertise around navigating the municipal sales process. I think there's a number of kind of real challenges to those processes, and then a number of sort of myths of impossibility. Mm-hmm. They're not impossible to sell into, and if you've got a product that's delivering real value to cities and you have some sense for how the process works, you can be fairly successful. They actually built a core competency inside the firm in order to help figure out where are we going to get the money from, what outside partners, what federal funding, in order to get the buy-in from the mayor, from the city councilor, along with the police chiefs. And actually also to build mindshare. So they developed their National Gunfire Index to kind of build mindshare each year about the problem. And so they got pretty good at selling to cities. I think it's a good message to companies that want to sell to cities that you can get good at it.
Yeah.
And then Ralph, because he's, you know, ambitious and interested to see how this technology can be used elsewhere, starts thinking about, well, now that we know how to do that, where else should we or could we be selling this technology?
Yeah. So let's dig into that a little bit. You know, everybody remembers that horrible day at Virginia Tech. For many, I was in a different university at the time, but in a university setting. For those of us, it was a real wake-up call that we needed to take this much more seriously. So there's a market, clearly, for this, but there's some challenges that they encounter just in terms of the technology, in terms of getting it indoors and having it work.
Yeah, so as Ralph was thinking about, you know, what next for the company, he's got two things on his mind. He's got horrible tragedies like Virginia Tech, like the school shooting at Sandy Hook. He also has a sense that his, you know, at the end of the day, there's maybe 1,500 public safety agencies he can sell ShotSpotter Flex to, and then that's their market.
Yeah.
So he is thinking about where do we go from here and how do we respond to these horrible tragedies? I think, again, he and his team thought we can do a couple of things. We can sell these outdoor sensors to other places that can make use of outdoor gunshot detection, like universities who have large campuses and want to know what's happening outside their buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Then they thought, well, we can also perhaps sell them to be used indoors, inside those university buildings, inside other school buildings, inside other private real estate assets like shopping malls and movie theaters, inside other public assets like airports and train stations. And that's where some of the technology gets actually a little bit interesting. I mean, gunfire sounds much different outdoors than it does indoors.
Yeah.
It's much more inconsistent, it turns out, indoors than it is outdoors, depending on the architecture and the flooring and the ceiling and the heights and everything else. In addition, there's an aesthetic interest for people who manage real estate. They want to know what things are going to look like.
Yeah.
And they had to make these ShotSpotter sensors smaller and better looking if they're going to deploy them indoors. There was a question around cost, because the truth is when you buy a ShotSpotter Flex system to work in an urban environment where there's lots of gunfire, you're going to end up using it. And when universities buy this, if they buy this, of course, they hope never, ever, ever to use it.
Right.
So there's a question on what are you going to price these things at, how are you going to charge for them, and interest to basically get the cost of the sensor down.
And they're not the only player in this space, right? There are other people that do what they do, and then there's sort of ancillary types of services.
Right. So that's the other big shift, is they're thinking about should we go into this business or not, is we haven't experienced basically almost any competition in the outdoor urban gunfire sensing business. There's very little competition. There's a little bit of technology out there that's been tested in military settings, et cetera, but basically, if you want outdoor gunshot detection for your city, ShotSpotter is the person you're going to go to. But as you said, indoors, it's a very different story. There's been a number of other companies that are trying to come up, trying to sell indoor gunshot detection and trying to sell security products more broadly.
So you've discussed this with your MBA students?
Yeah. So we actually had Ralph and Damon in class in my MBA course, Public Entrepreneurship, in the fall. And it was, as you can imagine, based on the questions and the topic, just a riveting discussion.
Yeah. How did they do on the test? I want to know how badly I stack up.
You did just as badly as they did, Brian.
Good. I feel better about that. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that there's some lessons to be learned here for any business person that's listening to this podcast. Maybe you want to just sort of cover those at a high level as we finish up.
The one thing is for businesses that want to sell in general, but especially to organizations that have long, labyrinth sales cycles, lots of barriers inside to getting stuff through, is you have to make sure the customer value proposition is truly, truly, truly there. And a lot of times people blame, you know, slow sales cycles in government for why they can't get their product into government. And I think oftentimes it's because the thing isn't existentially needed. Mm-hmm. A lesson from this case is that it turns out that urban gunfire detection is existentially needed, unfortunately, given the crisis of gun violence and gunfire we have in this country. The other lesson here is around moving to adjacencies. There's been, I think, a good amount of scholarship on how do you move from being in one business to being in another business. And I think one of the important things to realize is for a company like ShotSpotter to go from selling to cities to selling to shopping malls or universities is not one adjacency. Mm-hmm. It's probably two or three or four adjacencies. It's going to be a different product. It's going to be a different market. And realizing just how hard each of those adjacencies is going to be, what Ralph and what Damien and the company do is end up experimenting each step of the way as they move from one adjacency to the next and try not to leap at the whole thing all at once. I think it's a valuable lesson. Moving from one thing to the next is like doing six things all at once, and you need to test each step of the way.
Yeah, great insights. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find the ShotSpotter case along with thousands of others in the HBR case collection at hbr.org. I'm your host, Brian Kenny, and you've been listening to Cold Call, the official podcast of Harvard Business School.